Welcome to the Super Show, Super Story Series. My name is Bobby Karate, Super Show super fan, and lover of great storytelling. This is a companion series to the Super Show where we take a trip into the world of fantasy and adventure. Today we make a stop in the Heights where we hear a tale of its history and how it was born. Brilliantly narrated by Lord Macadel Barry Terrycloth III. Let the story begin.
Chapter 1. By order of the king.
The history of the Heights. Over 6 million years ago, the landmass known as the Heights was part of a complete peninsula that was over 2.7 million miles wide. A seismic meteor hit the earth and warped the atmosphere into a cold cycle that lasted over 3 million years. Gradually, the brutal below sub-zero temperatures and conditions weakened the land and it cracked, then split into six separate pieces. The northernmost section stayed in the largest piece, and has remained intact for the last 2.5 million years. In the northern heights, the land is vast and unique. There are desolate regions, sparkling waterways, snow-covered mountains and deep valleys. The highest elevation is 21,442 feet above sea level in the Highland Mountains. The country's lowest elevation is nearly 300 feet below sea level in Dun Desert in Fallon Valley. But, how did we get here? In 1599, King James of England and King Philip III of Spain joined forces to rid both countries of their growing problem of prison overcrowding. They agreed to fund a fleet of ships that would strand the political opposition and criminal elements of both countries onto far-reaching unpopulated areas on the map. King James believed he could get rid of opposition while still keeping public favor if the public thinks the king's enemies aren't being beheaded in a public spectacle, but being sent off to live somewhere they would be welcomed. One of those areas was the North Heights, because the harsh conditions would kill the prisoners in very short periods of time. In 1603, the Ming dynasty offered iron workers and general labor for free use of the same drop spots. England and Spain agreed, but before they could seal the deal, Charles V of Italy, in partnership with the Ottoman Turks of Greece, offered skilled seamen and shipbuilders in exchange for access. England and Spain secretly schemed to have China finance the fleets, which at their apex numbered nearly 700 ships, and that under the command of England's hand-picked ship captains, Greece and Italy would provide the manpower. England and Spain shrewdly anticipated the profits, considering neither would absorb the bill and yet still benefit. In 1606, the King of England appointed the recently knighted Captain Bevan Basilia to lead the first ship. The King of England sent Bevan on a journey to find the worst place in the world to drop the dregs of his dungeons. Each country sent 20 of their best seamen with Bevan on a trip expected to take 150 days. In early 1606, Bevan and crew boarded the brand new ship, the Fallon Monticarm, and headed for uncharted territory. The Greeks had built an amazing ship that was touted as the fastest in the world at the time.
Chapter 2. Mutiny.
The ship was over 120 feet long and 30 feet wide, with three masts and four gun tiers. The Greeks, known for their clipper style of shipbuilding, were instead influenced by the British to use the plans of master shipbuilder Jackson Hayhurst, who just happened to be an Englishman. The ship encountered one of the worst storms on record, severely damaging the ship. Half of the crew died of consumption, dehydration, and mutiny. On day 29, a Carmus Felon incited a mutiny that saw 10 men die and 15 more left to drown in the ocean. Yet, the Fallon Monticarm made it back in record time, despite the difficulties. Severely dehydrated, near death, fighting full-blown pneumonia, it would be 3 months before Bevan could give a report of his findings to the king. When Bevan finally revealed the location he felt would serve the king's purpose, the king ordered the Fallon Monticarm to set sail immediately with the first group of the condemned collected from each country's prisons. Acamas Philone, the Greek ship captain, was one of the 15 men left to drown in the ocean. A trusted member of the Ottoman Turks' inner circle, his disappearance strained the relationship between Greece and England. Before the Greeks would cooperate any further, they demanded to come to England and questioned Bevan about the circumstances surrounding Akamas' disappearance. Bevan maintained he was too sick from pneumonia and couldn't remember exact details. Months later, in front of an official committee representing each profiting country, Bevan told his story of a place that cannot be thawed. He called his discovery the Heights because the coastline is protected by a coast-long rock formation that gives the illusion of a high mountain range. The temperature was a frigid minus 20 and the ground, covered in ice, crunched like glass. He went on to explain that unless you were less than 100 miles away from the coastline it would appear unapproachable, which is why it had not been explored. Yali Kosmatos, a hulking man from Athens, slammed his fist and demanded to know why they were so close to the coastline. The entire committee, always unsure of England's transparency, also wanted to know why. Cornered, Bevan told of how Akamas convinced 14 crew members to mutiny and throw the Englishman off the vessel. Akamas killed 10 men before he was dropped in the ocean with any traitors who wanted to go with him. Akamas headed inland and on to shore. Bevan turned the Fallon Monticarm around and headed back to England. The Greeks were outraged. They left and swore to be as much opposition to the project as they could. Over the next 2 years, Greece and Italy waged wars with England and Spain, attacking ships, planting spies and sabotaging the other country's efforts. In the meanwhile, Greece was secretly funding ships to travel to the Heights to see what was so intriguing that would cause Philon to desert the Greek Navy.
Chapter 3. Yali Kosmatos.
The expeditions were led by Yali Kosmatos, now head of the Greek Navy. After 4 disastrous attempts, the Greeks finally reached the southern shore of the Heights. Kosmatos had never forgotten his friend of many years, and had hoped to gain some closure by exploring the coastline. Kosmatos was a brave soldier, but his temper and ego ruined what could have been a brilliant career in the Greek Navy. He made every mistake he could in getting to the Heights. Instead of English-designed ships that were big and fast, he built ships that were too big, slow and undergunned. With everything against him, he still made it to the coastline. After only 2 days, Kosmatos's landing party, which included over 400 men and animals, came upon a makeshift camp on the frozen tundra. They believed the land uninhabited. They approached and were attacked by Philon. Dressed in bloody animal skins with his teeth sharpened, Kosmatos barely recognized the dear friend he had risked his life to find. Kosmatos's men subdued Akamas, at which time he slumped in their arms, mumbling insanely in tears. From this point events get cloudy. For reasons unknown, Kosmatos refused to return to Greece. He ordered his men to bring all that they could from the ships and then burn what was left. Instantly, the party was divided and a war ensued. Kosmatos's loyal soldiers left over 120 of their own men dead. The rest chose to realize Kosmatos's mad dream of a new society in this harsh environment. While Kosmatos went insane, England had still not been able to send Bevan to the Heights with any prisoners. Most of England's ships were tied up fighting Greece and Italy. China, spending way too much for nothing, abandoned England and Spain. In the winter of 1610, the Ottoman Turks were overthrown and were no longer a threat to England, who in turn unleashed the full might of the British Navy on Italy. In the spring of 1611, Italy caved and withdrew any further aggression. With all obstacles cleared, England financed the massive super ship called the Drock Barge, which stood for Divine Right of Kings. King Philip, whose throne was under attack, rounded up all of his political enemies and sent them to England to be put on the Drock. During this extended furlough, Beaven had fallen on hard times. Depressed, and still unable to shake the effects of his prolonged battle with pneumonia, the once fit and trim man had become a thin, sickly drunk. Although Beaven was near death, he was still the only man in England who could lead the Drock to the heights. Beaven was a master planner, whose hand-drawn maps were impeccable.
Chapter 4. The Divine Right of Kings.
When the king's elite guard found Beaven, he was unconscious, face down in a tavern. The winter of 1611 was brutal, the waters were treacherous and out of control. Due to weather, and cleaning up Beaven, no ships left England for the heights. Meanwhile, England's prisons were overflowing. Spain continued sending prisoners from their dungeons, which caused shortages in housing, clothing and food for prisoners. Riots erupted, and it seemed that as if any day the very scum the king was trying to rid himself of would destroy his throne. Spain began applying pressure, and the king panicked and ordered daily beheadings to thin the numbers in his dungeons. In early 1612, King Philip was assassinated and the cruel Paphlas Foso assumed the throne. King Paphlas hated England and refused to cooperate. In the spring of 1612, Paphlas kidnapped and held Beaven in his dungeon for 6 years. In 1618, the Civil War of Spain exploded and King Paphlas was killed by his son, Sarasi. Sarasi handpicked a brute named Massimo to succeed the throne. Massimo was an educated man with big ideas that included cooperating with England to get all of Paphlas' supporters out of Spain as soon as possible. Massimo quickly returned Beaven to England with gifts and livestock for the king. In the summer of 1618, China returned with financing and expert ironsmiths to craft the holding cells in the ship. The bow was sloped and reinforced to make it unsinkable. The Drock was the most durable ship in the world, over 210 feet long and 65 feet wide with 6 masts and 6 gun tiers. The Drock held over 500 prisoners and was the heaviest vessel ever at that time. Finally, all the stars in the heavens lined up and the Drock set loaded in the harbor ready to go. Beaven's best years were definitely behind him. He had a noticeable jitter after spending 6 years in a Spanish prison. But for his king, who too was aging, Beaven mustered the will to lead the Drock. In the fall of 1619, Beaven and his crew of 250 of the world's best seamen landed on the southeast shore of the Heights. Although Beaven had made the trip twice before, September 7, 1619 is regarded as the date the Heights was officially discovered. Originally for the King of England. The exact spot where the Drock landed would eventually become known as Beaven's Coast in honor of the man who discovered it. All of Europe began profiting from the Drock's voyages. Over the next 3 years, Beaven headed every trip to the Heights, constantly updating his maps.
Chapter 5. 1622.
In 1621, Beaven, now almost 60, began blacking out and hearing voices. King James, near 80, was fighting off attacks to his throne from his nephew Joffe, and was of no support to Beaven. In 1622, Joffe seized the throne in a brutal uprising that lasted 4 days. King James was yanked from his castle, and beheaded in front of his supporters. Shattered by the news of the king's death, Beaven blacked out for 2 days. When he awoke, he had lost all of his sense of hearing. He would later say that without his king, he didn't need to hear any other voice. Joffe quickly sprang into action and ordered Beaven to ready the Drock and load all of King James's court and supporters into it. Beaven, too old to fight, did what he was told and set sail for the Heights. As the Drock approached the coastline, Vivan noticed a large campfire further up the beach. The Drok had made over 20 trips to the heights, and each trip back Vivan would send an expedition to confirm the deaths of the last trip's prisoners. Each time, at least 90% of the prisoners were confirmed dead, the other 10% were presumed to have made it further inland and were dealt with in other ways, i.e., exposure to the elements, animals or other survivors. Vivan knew that there should not be a campfire in the heights because there should be no way to make one. Vivan ordered his crew to fire all 6 cannons at the coastline. Instantly, heavy cannon fire is returned from the coastline, severely damaging the Drok. Half of Bevan's crew was dead or drowning, and the Drok, as indestructible as it was supposed to be, was barely afloat. Undaunted, Vivan and what was left of his crew headed toward the coastline. When he reached the coast, Akamas Filon's army attacked and ate most of his crew. The severe conditions, and lack of food, had turned Filon and his army into cannibals. Beaten back to the beach, Vivan gathered his surviving crew, and headed back to England. After Vivan explained to King Joffrey that Filon was a serious threat, he collapsed at his feet and died. King Joffrey idolized Vivan and felt that revenge was the only way to repay Bevan's loyalty to the throne. That's what he told the crowds outside of the palace to calm them in the wake of the death of one of Britain's most beloved heroes. He was also smart enough to know that if Akamas Filon could get his hands on England's prisoner barges, they could feasibly form a bigger army of vicious cannibals. They had to be removed. Li Lang, a disgraced ronin from Osaka, Japan, sold England his designs for the earliest version of the modern pistol. With this new weaponry, England's navy could hit the shore and kill all of Filon's soldiers and confirm their deaths, as opposed to the messy, random accuracy of cannonballs fired from the coastline.
Chapter 6. Kill them all.
In 1623, King Joffrey sent most of the British Navy in new super ships to the heights with the orders to kill them all. Filon had named his region New Athens in respect to his homeland. Secretly, his armies had been receiving goods and supplies from defectors in Greece for months and were equipped to survive the harsh conditions. Filon and Kosmatos had fortified huts, meeting halls and even meat freezers constructed for their soldiers. One of Bevan's most trusted aides, a gruff Englishman named Millis Brown, was appointed by Joffrey to fill Bevan's shoes. General Millis Brown and 50 ships of Britain's naval soldiers crashed the Heights' southern coast and slaughtered all of Filon's army. Captain Brown returned to England with Filon's head in burlap for the king. By this time, England had partnerships with over 30 countries to process and ship prisoners to the Heights. King Joffrey had successfully done what King James, King Philip, or even the Ottoman Turks could not do. Business was good and the king was getting richer. China paid for the fleets and their upkeep. Greece and Italy provided manpower. Business was so good that Joffrey began to get careless. When Captain Brown and the other ship captains would give their reports to the king, he seemed to ignore that fewer and fewer prisoners' bodies were being found. Joffrey wrote it off as animals carrying bodies further inland. At this time, the common intelligence of this planet could not comprehend what was happening in the heights. It was neither animals nor a will to survive that was saving the prisoners. For reasons still unknown, another shift in the atmosphere had begun to warm the climate and stabilized weather conditions. Some of the prisoners had even stumbled upon the deserted New Athens region and had begun to rebuild. For the next 15 years, King Joffrey ignored requests from Captain Brown and others investigated the problem. He continued to profit from the trips and didn't care. In 1638, a prisoner barge was attacked and beaten back by 1,500 prisoners. Joffrey quickly realized that if the criminal populace of the Heights continued to prosper, they could become a threat to England. The king decided to send the full force of the British Navy and its allies to regain control of the heights. King Joffe decided to stop shipping prisoners and instead turn the heights into a penal colony. Captain Brown was now the head of the Navy and planned the entire project. Captain Brown was from a long line of naval men. His father, four uncles, three brothers, and 14 cousins were all respected seamen. Captain Brown selected all of his relatives to accompany him to the heights. In 1639, Captain Brown demanded England to enlist the 101-year-old Jackson Hayhurst to design a new Falon Montcalm. It was the only ship to successfully navigate the waters of the North Heights and return undamaged.
Chapter 7. Brownsville.
Joffe, now suffering from an unknown infection, sent his uncle Osbrook to ask Hayhurst for one more favor for the throne. Hayhurst's designs were the most complex in the world and could not be built without Hayhurst on site. When Osbrook arrived, he found Hayhurst in no condition to work outside for 6 months while a super ship was built. Hayhurst was frail, distant, and had trouble remembering names. Hayhurst's daughter Olivia had been a lifelong student of her father's and volunteered to supervise his plans. Shortly after returning to England, work on the new Falon, called Falon Congregate, began. In 1639, Captain Brown led the Congregate to the southern beach of the Heights, intent on rebuilding the new Athens campsite into a fortified prison facility. The prisoners were a formidable opponent because they knew the terrain and had developed many hiding places and escape routes. The War of Athens lasted 2 years and left over 1,000 prisoners and English dead. Captain Brown finally defeated the prisoners and gained control of the new Athens campsite in 1641. By 1643, Captain Brown had turned the region into a thriving city. With over 20 of Captain Brown's relatives assisting in the running of the prison, the inmates nicknamed the new Athens campsite Brownsville for obvious reasons. Captain Brown, a hero throughout England, was given complete control of the Heights and of Brownsville. For the next 17 years, England reaped untold fortunes from their island prison. In 1661, England broke off ties with China, Spain, and Italy, citing no longer a need for partners. Enraged, China and Spain began a program of their own, and Italy dropped out of contention due to political unrest and financial woes. Slowly, Captain Brown organized explorations further into the Heights, attempting to settle the terrain for England. In 1669, King Joffe died in his sleep and his uncle Osbrook became King of England. Osbrook was notoriously cheap, and immediately sought ways to cut the costs of the Heights while raising the profits even further than they were. Osbrook began reducing the funds for prisoners' food, clothing, and Captain Brown's explorations. By 1670, almost 800 of the 2,500 prisoners had died from lack of care. Brechel Schofield, a rowdy inmate from Scotland, organized an uprising to free the prisoners of the conditions. Brechel had been convicted of acts against the throne and was very anti-government, but a brilliant strategist. In 1671, the War of Freedom erupted in a bloody massacre called Red Monday. On Monday, January 9, 1671, guards found food Brechel had stolen for a sick prisoner and beat him unconscious. This act incited the others, and one of them rammed a stick into a guard's neck. Utter mayhem. The bloodshed lasted for months, until an army led by Brechel Schofield crushed the British.
Chapter 8. A Scot Named John.
Captain Brown lost most of his family and promptly retired upon returning to England. King Osbrook lost a fortune in gold and nearly broke the throne. King Osbrook's rivals seized the opportunity and stabbed him to death. A Scot named John became king of both England and Scotland and had no intention of wasting any more money on the heights. In 1675, Brechin Schofield sent a letter by courier to King John that outlined his demands. Brechin ordered that no further heights expeditions or contact be financed by England. He warned that if these parameters were not obeyed, his soldiers would pillage the English coastline. King John sent a return letter attached to the headless body of Brechin's courier that read, "If you or your brethren ever return to England, you will receive the same." The king did agree not to venture near the heights as long as Brechin pledged never to return to England. The heights became independent of England officially in 1676.
Tune in next time to experience more of the fantastical world of the heights.
Heights.